This is Thursday, October 25th, 2007. I am Leanne Diakoff, and I am interviewing Eugene Roos at St. Paul United Methodist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, about his naval service during World War II. Mr. Roos, I'll ask you to just start by telling us a little bit about yourself before the war, where you were born, a little bit about your family, where you grew up.
People call me Gene, born in Rockford, Illinois on October 18, 1922. And my family there, I lived there until 1928 when my dad was transferred to a sewing machine needle factory, manager of a sewing machine needle factory in Orange, Massachusetts. As most of you who know anything about history understand that 1928 was the year before 1929. And as a result of that catastrophe, my dad's duties out there ended up closing up that plant. And we moved back to Rockford at that time in about 1931, I believe it was, not exactly sure. I have two sisters, an older sister, Mary Louise, younger sister, Carol Charlotte. Mary Louise was born in 1919, and she died very young in 1967. At the age of 48. My younger sister did better than that. She lived until December of 1998. My father lived to be 75. He was born in 1891, died in 1966. My mother died very young also at the age of 52. And all cancer victims so far in the family. Dad remarried 4 years later to a lady named Edna Peterson, who still survives in a nursing home in Rockford, Illinois. Of course, the early years in the 30s were depression years. My father was very lucky up until 1941. He maintained employment. In 1941, the company he worked for was sold to folks who eventually shut the place down. And so he was adrift in 1941. How they managed to pay my tuition at the University of Illinois that year, I don't know, but they got it done. He went about 6 or 8 months unemployed, and he finally made another connection with a company in Rockford that was relatively young, Rockford Screw Products Company it was called. And he was the office manager there.
How would you describe, you've mentioned this was kind of during the Depression and the years afterwards, how would you describe, I guess, your childhood status? Were you middle class or working class?
Middle class, I would say. The fact that you kept your employment was something to be very grateful about, because that unemployment at one point was as high as 20% in this country. And companies were folding left and right. In Rockford, Illinois, in those days, was a heavily furniture manufacturing company. And in those days, we exported jobs, but they went to North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Now we export them to Mexico and who knows where. So Rockford evolved out of that from the furniture, centered on furniture, to a heavily machine tool center. Rockford was, and of course that was hammered after the war and for a number of years later by foreign competition also. But it would be middle class. We were certainly more fortunate than many, many people. Even those, many of those folks kept their jobs, kept them at much reduced compensation levels, and pretty much nervous all the time about what the next day would bring. So childhood, we were always aware of that, but we also were, our family made sure that we understood how fortunate we were that Dad was still employed. You know. Our next door neighbor, for instance, was a contractor, carpenter contractor. And when the banks closed in 1933, one of the early things that FDR did was close the banks to try to slow or prevent bank runs. He had just made a deposit from one of his customers, I think, and it was $1,500, as I recall, which would have been lots of money, to cover his payroll next time. And the day after he made that deposit, they closed his bank. And it turned that family very bitter. And it was a close-by lesson of what can happen to people suddenly in that period of time. We've had nothing to approach it since. We've had periods of difficult economic times in the country. But for people to compare anything we've gone through in the last 40 years or 50 years with a Great Depression is unrealistic. Not so.
What kind of education did you have growing up?
Yes, I went to the University of Illinois in September of 1941, at a time when Dad was just recently unemployed. I think he borrowed against his insurance. He did all, you know, wherever they could scrape together. Anyway, they sent me to the University of Illinois in 1941. I got through that year, but I didn't like it. I was not happy there. As a matter of fact, in retrospect, I described myself as not prepared, immature at the time. I got through it, but I didn't like it. Didn't like the campus, and probably used as an excuse for not applying myself very much. The second year, some friends of mine in Rockford had gone to the University of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And so I went one semester to Miami and Oxford, Ohio. And while I was there, I enlisted in the Navy. And I finished that first semester and didn't know when they were going to call me up, so didn't go back the second semester.
What made you decide to enlist in the Navy?
Family history, probably. I have an uncle who was a Naval Academy graduate and was a Naval aviator. And I think that was the trigger on the thing. He was, nowadays they call it a role model, I guess. Mm-hmm. Then you just admired him.
Can you remember the day you enlisted?
It took me three times. I had the first two times I was a shade on the wrong side of blood pressure and pulse. And so I was advised to go home in a month, try again in a month after I did some strenuous exercising, running, that sort of thing.
And did you?
Yes. Got in the third effort. In the meantime, I wasn't sure I was going to get in there. This was in 1942. Mm-hmm. In 1941, after Pearl Harbor, and I was at University of Illinois at that time. In fact, I was at a rush party on that Sunday and when the news came over. And another friend of mine, I can't recall his name, we went over to St. Louis and tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And never heard back from him. I guess at the time, when things settled a little bit and they decided that it didn't make sense for the Royal Canadian Air Force to be drawing on Americans who were in the war now themselves. So I never heard back from them.
What interested you in the Royal Canadian Air Force versus signing up for the
just,
Air Corps?
It was just near, you know, it's a next door country, neighbors. You know, you almost felt like they were Americans or like they were United States citizens almost, you know. Mm-hmm. In those days, there wasn't any contention that I recall at all. There's some now, of course. But it was a rush, probably, that was not very well considered.
Yeah.
But as I've been so fortunate in my whole life, I was fortunate they did not call me. Yeah.
Thinking back to this rush party where you heard the news about Pearl Harbor, can you describe that? Do you remember?
Oh yeah,
how they announced it and the mood.
Yeah, well, it was about lunchtime. It's about 5 or 6 hours difference in the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we finished. I think people scattered back to their. It was a rush party, so a lot of people there were like I was as a guest. Went back to their dormitories or wherever and got a radio wherever they could and sat by that radio and listened every minute up for the rest of the day. And it was a consuming thing. It was such a jolting thing. And of course, it concentrated the country's attention on what had happened out there and what a threat it was, and the determination just took over. There was no doubt in our minds in the end we'd do the job. But the young men that I was involved in, you know, I was in the men's dormitory and the men's fraternity house, those fellows all knew they were of an age group that obviously was going to get involved some way if they were healthy at all. And of course, I don't remember any of them dragging a foot. You know.
Was there a big rush to run out and enlist?
pardon me. I don't recall that. I don't think there was.
Mm-hmm.
Although I shouldn't answer that in a positive way at all, because I'm really not sure.
Yeah.
I made that effort to go to St. Louis, and I don't know if many people tried to do that sort of thing to get in some other service where they could move more rapidly. The country was so ill prepared that it didn't have facilities or equipment or anything else to handle a rush of people who wanted to be pilots, for instance. They didn't have the facilities, the airfields, or any the equipment, the airplanes, the instructors, or anything, you know. So there wasn't any reason for the Air Force to rush out and try to enlist a whole bunch of people that they couldn't properly handle anyway. Some of that, I think, was true. Even in my case, where I didn't get I enlisted in October of 42, and they didn't call me till May of 43. So there's what 7-8 month gap until they were prepared to take people who had enlisted about the time I did. So it took them that long to get organized, and in retrospect, I think maybe they wanted to accommodate these folks who wanted to enlist. And I don't know for sure if it's true or not, but in retrospect, years later, I thought they maybe stretched out the training period longer than they would necessarily have had to do as far as the training itself was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But to absorb these people, I was 18 months in my cadet training before I finished the flight training and was commissioned and got my wings. And I don't think the Air Force, Army Air Corps at that time, I don't think their training was anywhere near that long. Of course, we were headed for the Pacific. That was pretty obvious to start with. They were headed to Europe, where the concentration was the battle pace of the war was much greater than it was in the Pacific. And so I don't know about that, and other things that are interesting in retrospect, I guess, that are the places I was stationed were scattered all over the Navy. I was at Monmouth, Illinois, my first assignment, not too close to the oceans for the Navy, and then Laramie, Wyoming, and St. Mary's, California, Livermore, California.
Didn't want you to get too close to the water on your first.
Well, I think what it really was, Leanne, was that each congressman got something, and mainly they tried to keep their schools going, their colleges going. So a lot of those bases were attached to a school of some sort, Monmouth College, University of Wyoming, St. Mary's College, and a strong suspicion is that each congressman demanded that something be done for his district. And if it took the Navy in Wyoming, okay, I don't care.
Well, so it took you three tries to enlist, and on the third time, I guess
I had flat feet, too, but they were congenital, if that's the right word for it. It wasn't, and they didn't hurt me at all, and I remember trying to stand on the edges of my feet because they did look for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, and the guy looked at it once, and he said, "Relax," and I eased a little bit, and he let it go.
So you
got in.
Squeaked by.
Yeah.
So where did you enlist? Did you have to go?
It was in Columbus, Ohio, because I was attending Oxford, Ohio, Miami University in Oxford, Ohio at the time. I went to Columbus, Ohio to do that.
And after you enlisted, and I guess signed your name, signed a contract or something, did they just send you back to school?
They didn't care what you did.
Oh, okay.
They just said, do it. Whatever you were doing, go back and do it. I'm sure some people were just working. A lot of them were in school. And I think most of them did what I did. They finished the semester.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been called anything. We didn't know when they were going to call us. They just said it probably won't be until next year, which would have been 1943, 2 or 3 months. I think that was as close as they would come to to speculating on when the call-up might be, and it went clear till May. So I stopped school and went back home to Rockford. And
what was your family's reaction to your decision to enlist?
When I called my parents about it, I was ecstatic. I think Mother's comment was, well, I'm not sure it's so good. Something to that effect.
Mother's.
But it was her brother who was the naval aviator. Yeah. Half-brother. Half-brother.
And your father?
No comment.
No comment. So you went back home and...
I think I worked in a gas station or, I don't remember, odd jobs, just filling the time and earning a few bucks and dating some girls, including the one I married.
Time well spent. So then when and how did you get called up?
Just got a letter. I think there was about 2 weeks' notice or so, and I think the date was May 12th. I think that's right. It was just a Navy letter of report to so-and-so on such-and-such a date. And I remember climbing on a train out of Rockford, and I don't know whether it certainly wasn't a train directly to Monmouth, Illinois. So I probably went to Chicago, and frankly, I'm not sure we got to Monmouth in the end on a train or on a bus. I'm not sure.
Well, what do you remember about showing up for training and your first training stint?
Yeah, just exciting. Speculation, that sort of thing, wondering what kind of people you'd meet and what kind of quarters, and just a young man's concern about or anticipation about doing something that was kind of a dream. Of course, I'd never thought about that. If the war hadn't come along, I never would have expected to be a naval involved with the Navy at all. So it was something new. Felt it was a path to do something worthwhile.
Did you know at this point that you were going to work on getting a pilot, to become a pilot?
Yeah, we enlisted as pilots. The Navy called that program the V-5 program. There was another V-7 program for people who aspired to be in the surface Navy. Mm-hmm. And maybe there were some others too, I'm not sure, but those two I remember in mind was a V-5 program, and we were headed to be pilots. We didn't know, we didn't make a selection of the kind of airplane that would be most interested in until advanced training, well over a year after that.
Well, what kind of accommodations did they give you in Monmouth?
It was a college campus, so we lived in the dormitories. Of course, the student population just disappeared suddenly from almost all colleges, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that was the effort to keep those colleges, keep their heads and noses above water. Mm-hmm. And so the Navy used lots of those. So it was ground school studying and physical education, heavy emphasis on that. And some drilling, that sort of thing, close order drilling it was called, matter of building discipline and responsiveness and respect for authority and that sort of thing.
And what did you think?
Pardon me?
What did you think?
Oh, I liked it. I should add, I guess, that in high school I was in the ROTC.
Okay.
So I had some initial interest in the military, but never thought of it as a career. And I got to be a company commander in high school, ROTC, and enjoyed it. And so I had a little leg up on a lot of the fellows who hadn't had ROTC, so I knew what left and right and
yeah, knew about authority and
yeah. As a matter of fact, when I graduated from that high school ROTC program, the company I commanded gave me a going away present, which still hangs in our den. It's a saber and a scabbard, chrome plated. Hangs on the wall in our den.
You left an impression.
And I think I got to be a company commander at Monmouth too, because they were organized in those kinds of units.
Mm-hmm. And then so Monmouth was physical training and ground training.
Ground school, yeah.
And And this was just for naval, the V-5?
Yes, just the V-5, just Navy people there.
And then from Monmouth, how long were you there?
I should mention one thing. I only remember one instructor at Monmouth, and he was an attorney, probably 50 years old, I'm guessing, 45, 50 years old, who really wanted to be active if he could have been, but he was too old. He taught himself, or he was taught, I guess, the fundamentals of dead reckoning navigation. He taught a navigation dead reckoning, which means without instruments. It's dead reckoning training at Monmouth, and was just an outstanding guy. His name was Quinby. I can't remember his first name. Soon he went back to his law practice after the war, but he devoted a good deal of his time. Whether he was ever paid for it, I don't know. I don't know if they were. I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I would think they must have been paid something. But he was an outstanding instructor.
And did you use some of his advice and training?
Well, he just taught this navigation course, yeah, and did an excellent job of it. So I don't think anybody flunked it because he made it so you could understand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long were you at?
3 months at Monmouth. Give or take, approximately 3 months.
And then where did they send you?
Then they sent us to that big, great naval station in Laramie, Wyoming. It was attached to the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And that was where we got our first flight time, along with ground school and physical training and the rest of it, but the initial training in small single engine airplanes.
Was this your first time in an airplane?
No, I had, during that interim between the enlistment and call-up, I took several flying lessons, private flying lessons in Rockford, Illinois. Maybe 6 hours or so, something like that.
What was your first impression the first time you got up in a plane?
Exhilaration.
You knew this was something for you?
Yeah.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
So in Laramie, you got a little more?
Lots of more ground school and physical education, of course, which is heavily emphasized all the way through. Mm-hmm. We were pretty sure that the Japanese were small, but didn't mean that they were weaklings. And the emphasis, or a lot of it, was the airplane's made to stay in the air, but they don't always do that. And maybe you might have to someday face them on the ground, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the airplanes that we flew in Laramie were, in those days, the Cub and the Aranca were the two main small airplanes. And there was another one called a Luscombe, which, in our opinion at least, was a much better airplane. The Cub and the Aranca were fabric-covered, even the fuselages were. The Luscombe was an aluminum fuselage. And we thought it was a better airplane. That's part of that's ego. Everybody wants to think theirs is the best, I guess.
Yeah.
Whatever they do is the best. Anyway, Laramie was a little special in its challenges because the airport was 7,200 feet above sea level. So these small airplanes didn't have abilities to climb much more than 10 or 12,000 feet above sea level. So we were flying at near its, within 3,000 or 4,000 feet is all you were ever off the ground. Mm-hmm. Most of the other fields were much lower. Sandiford Field is about 500 or 600 feet, something like that, mm-hmm. as a comparison. And so we were there also for about 3 months. And Laramie is kind of isolated. Cheyenne was, I don't remember, 80, 90 miles maybe. Denver, 150, something like that. Mm-hmm. We didn't, in some of the other stations, there were population centers closer. So we didn't do much, I don't remember much socializing or chasing around at Laramie, Wyoming.
When you had free time, it was just...
Yeah, didn't have much free time to start with, and there wasn't much exciting to do. And I don't even know whether it was a dry county or not. I don't remember that.
It's a very straight-laced 3 months.
Yeah. The university continued to operate, but the V-5 program probably kept its head above water.
Mm-hmm. And when you left Laramie, where were you as far as your pilot's training?
We had soloed there in this small airplane. Mm-hmm. maybe had 25 hours total. I'm not, give or take. Yeah. I looked for my logbook, and it's probably buried in the CPAC. I got that out of there, but I didn't find it. Mm-hmm. So, every time you fly, you fill out an entry, you make an entry in this logbook mm-hmm. for as long as you fly. That's the way it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. And where did you go after Laramie?
A small college in California called St. Mary's. St. Mary's, not too far from the San Francisco area. I think it might have been an all-male school. I'm not positive about that. Picturesque area. That was all ground school again. All ground school and physical education. We were getting more advanced navigation instruction there and some other ground school subjects, but there was no flying done there. And we were there about... that was another 3 months. Most of those segments were 3 months mm-hmm. each. So, but it was in the California area, and Hollywood in those days, there were patriots. Those folks were patriots, and it wasn't difficult for the staff, I think, to get people to come up there to entertain us, male and female, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can't name any of them, but they were available, which lightened the days a little bit. We did have a little free time there. I think we usually went into Oakland mm-hmm. from there, and they provided buses and transportation to and from a specific location in Oakland back to the base at St. Mary's. So that was pretty much routine.
Do you remember at this time, I guess it's probably late 43, do you remember getting any reports about what was going on the war front?
Oh, yeah.
And did that cause you any anxieties? Or?
Well, the attitude was that we're going to win this thing. And it was no surprise that there were ups and downs. The Guadalcanal campaign, I guess, focused our attention as much as any of the others did. It was the first really major one that was a hellhole. And... there was a determination that shrugged off, if that's not too casual a term to say, individual difficulties in the war itself, mm-hmm. that it was a stage we were going to have to go through and we were going to finish it and win it.
And during this course of training, were you able to communicate with your family back home in Illinois? And
yeah, of course, telephones weren't used much in those days, but the mail was. We had what were called emails. Mm-hmm. Is that right? That doesn't sound, that's not emails, for heaven's sakes. there was a special name for for mailing materials that were the paper companies developed, which were very, very light. They weighed almost nothing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what the heck did they call those? Terrible. Yes, I got good mail from my folks. Didn't hear much from my sisters, but heard from my parents, my mother particularly, but Dad wrote too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I can't remember specifically. I suppose we talked on the phone once or twice. I don't know, but it was never thought to be a thing that you would just go pick up a phone like you do now, you know.
Were you able to get home for the for any holidays or any
parades? Let's see now. I think I got home for Christmas of 43 mm-hmm. for a few days. But other than that, I don't remember coming home. Mm-hmm. And I don't think my folks never visited me, even in Monmouth, Illinois. Transportation, you know, was difficult with the rationing and all in those days. He just didn't do much driving. And it just didn't lend itself to that. And most of the guys, there were a very few of them that the mothers visited them down there. And it was always kind of an eyebrow-raising situation when a mother came down to visit her son and the baby.
You boys out becoming men.
Yeah, gotta be macho from age 6.
Well, we're okay. So St. Mary's, California, and that was mostly ground.
All ground.
And at what point did they decide? Well, I guess where did you go after that?
Yeah, that was Livermore, also in California, also in the San Francisco area. You hear it now of Livermore National Laboratories. Mm-hmm. Facilities are there. It was what was called, the Navy called that primary training. And this was ground school. You had ground school all through the whole program. Mm-hmm. And then various levels of flight training. And this went from the small little Luscombe Cub-type, Aranca-type airplanes to what an airplane that was called an N-3N. The Navy's designation was the N-3N. I think the Army used them also, but under a different designation. They were a single-engine biplane, much heavier than the Luscombe was. Two-place, front and rear. And learned much more about flying, a lot of work on aerobatics and how to get out of emergency situations, stalls and spins and that sort of thing. And lots of landings.
What was that like the first time you had to?
Thrilling.
Going
after. Yeah. But they were necessary maneuvers to learn because if they happened accidentally or due to poor pilot capabilities, you had to have some idea of how to correct them, and you can't do that without having been through it. So you did it first with instructors, so you had good backup. You know, they didn't throw you into that situation without a number of them being done by an instructor and then with the instructor. To give you some idea of the attitudes an airplane must be in combat, and a lot of it is how to get out of difficult situations and land relatively safely, at least, you know. I don't remember how many hours we took there. Probably, I would guess at least 50 hours probably of training at Livermore. I think that was maybe 4 months. I'm not exactly sure of that. One of the highlights there, the things that you remember, is Robert Taylor was, do you remember Robert Taylor? Do you remember that name?
Yeah.
He was the heartthrob of the 40s, and he was an instructor at Livermore.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I never had him as an instructor, but met him, mm-hmm. And, of course, he was subject to a lot of questionings about subjects that you can guess. His stock answer was, well, everybody knew about Errol Flynn's, but not mine. I don't think he was married to Barbara Stanwyck by that time. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was by far the highlight of the training up to that point, because the flying was much more intense.
Yeah.
And the experiences were more intense. These were open cockpit airplanes, too, besides. So you were, you know, you knew you were moving. You know, you had a much more closer relationship with the flying experience in an open airplane.
What's the weather like up there in an open cockpit?
Well, in California, and we didn't fly that high there because it was sea level just about. Mm-hmm. So we seldom were above 5,000 feet. Weather changes 3 degrees per 1,000 feet of elevation as a rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. So if you're 5,000 feet, it might be 15 degrees cooler, and then it's 80 on the ground. It's still not too bad, you know. Mm-hmm. In Wyoming, 3,000 feet above the ground, that puts you at 10,000 feet. But those are closed airplanes, too. And then in Wyoming, we were there in the fall. By the time we got to Livermore, it was late in the year. Late in the year, yeah.
And by this time, did you know, were you going to fly solo in a plane, or did you?
Well, we soloed.
We
soloed at Wyoming, mm-hmm. At Laramie, but those were those small single engine airplanes. Then at each other level, you had to be solo qualified also, mm-hmm. Just because you soloed in a Luscombe didn't mean you could solo immediately without instructions and a steerman in 3N. So yes, you probably flew another 6 or 8 or 10 hours before they would let you solo those. They were a more difficult airplane to land. The landing gear was relatively narrow compared to the size of the airplane, and was subject to wind gusts that didn't have to be very strong for it could affect you, particularly on landings, mm-hmm. where you were slowing down and you got a gust of wind that would get you tail wagging. And I got caught in one of those one time, and it's called ground looping. The airplane doesn't turn over, it just turns around. Oh my. And quickly. And is greatly to be avoided if you're ready your reputation as a flyer.
Did you have an answer for that in the mess hall?
Yeah. Well, I was brought before, they called him some kind of a board, I'm not sure what it was, brought before a board to review that incident, and I thought I'd sunk a battleship. But they didn't wash me out, fortunately, thank goodness, given another chance. Also at Laramie, another horrible mistake, but they never found out about this one, because it was solo. They had the main air base, and then they had a bunch of outlying small airports for landing practices and that sort of thing, mainly for landing practice. And at one of those outlying fields one day, I landed downwind. Other airplanes were landing like they should. Fortunately, nothing ever happened there. Never could have been a bad situation, but yeah. I was solo, so nobody else knew about that. And on my check ride at that same outlying airport, I guess I landed the smoothest landing I ever had in the whole naval career. Just pilots called it greasing it, mm-hmm. and had one of those landings on the check ride, so the instructor was very impressed.
So you left a good impression.
Yeah.
Well, after St. Mary's, in this this more complicated flight training you had there, then where did they decide to send you? And did they send you all as the same group, or at that point do they kind of divide you up?
Well, at that point, there were two advanced bases. One was in Corpus Christi, where I went. The other one was Florida. Mm-hmm. Good heavens. Pensacola. And those were the two advanced training bases. So these people who had started out at Monmouth, and then they'd split up, and some went from Monmouth to other bases. I went to St. Mary's, but there were a whole bunch of other ones. And then it started
concentrating back to
the advanced training, where all of them came back eventually to either Pensacola or Corpus Christi. I went to Corpus Christi.
So had when
no
you,
choice.
When you got back to Corpus, when you got to Corpus Christi, you were with men who you had started out with in
yes.
Monmouth, or and
mm-hmm.
you
a few of them, yes. Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Corpus is where they gave you a chance to choose what kind of airplane you wanted to fly. In the long run, and I chose multi-engine. I think I was a competent pilot, but I didn't feel that I was sufficiently competent to do a good job flying a single-engine airplane off an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. So I worked on myself and decided I would try to find an airplane that had as many engines out that side, engines out that side, and have other people aboard to be a part of the crew, you know. Anyway, and maybe in the back of my mind, the uncle that I mentioned to you that was a naval aviator, he flew patrol bombers also. When he was in the Navy and flying those things, they were called PBYs, Catalinas. And they were twin-engine airplanes that some of them were strictly seaplanes, and some were had adaptations, including wheels on them, so they could land either in the water or on lands. But they were a lumbering airplane, cruised at about 110 knots. Mm-hmm. And he was in they called them Black Cat Squadrons, because the Catalina, and then they're almost all of their flights in the South Pacific were at night because they were so slow they would be determined, and their mission was low-level anti-shipping. And maybe that was in the back of my mind a little bit too. And in our long-term transition, we did fly those PBYs in further transitions to other airplanes. Mm-hmm. That may have been back of my mind a little bit too. But then my closest friends also were leaning towards multi-engine airplanes, so it was kind of wasn't any traumatic sitting down and cogitating for hours about what to do. It just kind of flowed naturally.
Yeah. So, but when you made that decision...
Pardon me, I should say that the idea of flying airplanes off aircraft carriers did not appeal to me.
Okay, that was going to be my next question.
Was in
so
my
when you
mind.
Made that decision, you knew you were narrowing down what type of...
They could have upset those decisions, but I think the split was sufficient that I don't know anybody that wanted to fly multi-engines that were forced to fly other airplanes, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the Navy had more than... They had a range of single-engine airplanes. They weren't all fighters. Mm-hmm. There were dive bombers and there were torpedo bombers and the reconnaissance planes that flew off of battleships, for instance. Mm-hmm. In the multi-engine, my recollection is that the Navy only used four-engine patrol bombers. The Marines, who were a part of the Navy in those days, maybe they still are, I don't think so, but in those days, the Marines were part of the... So the Marines took the same training course. They were part of the same training course, and at Corpus Christi, those that wanted to be in the Marines selected the Marines, and the others didn't. Mm-hmm. And Marines had some different airplanes than the Navy did.
Mm-hmm. So what did they start... After you had chosen your airplane in Corpus Christi, then what did they start teaching you?
Well, we first started there, even there at single-engine airplanes also, okay. But again, heavier airplanes. We called them Vol-T vibrators, we called them. I can't remember the Navy designation other than that became such a common term to identify that airplane. And it was a two-place airplane, but considerably heavier. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many hours we hit. I really don't know, maybe 20 or 30 hours in that. And after we finished then, that was when we made the decision to go either stay with a single-engine type airplane or the patrol bomber multi-engine type planes. And so the guys who chose single engines, they went on to do even a heavier, closer to operational type airplane, succeeding the Vol-T. And we went into twin-engine beach airplanes. They were, the Navy's designation was SBN, and they were manufactured by Beech Aircraft Corporation, and a very, very excellent transitional training plane, and survived many years after the war, too, as a small corporate airplane, for instance, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And so we had a number of additional hours of that, and that's when our night flying started at Corpus, and celestial navigation started at that point, still other ground training studies, that sort of thing. Tried to learn a little bit about the mechanics of the airplane, started learning a little bit about radio navigation. Radar was just coming into use in the early versions of radar, and I think we got to Corpus in we were there about 5 months, I think May or June, up until we finished in November. Mm-hmm. So that was the longest stretch, but it covered training in that Vol-T and the more advanced training in the SBN twin engine Beechcraft. They had that beach for training purpose. They had it equipped with gun turrets and let's see, did they have, I'm trying to remember whether they had a bomb bay or not. They were never used in combat, but it was a training thing to get you used to the the environment of that, with that sort of equipment on it. I know they had a twin 50 caliber nose turret. It wasn't all that big an airplane. I don't know what to.
How many crew would you carry on?
In those, just two, usually just you and an instructor.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes an observer would come along with, maybe another cadet might fly along, but nothing, no assigned, didn't need it in that airplane.
So when you were doing your night flying and doing celestial navigation, that was just you, right? You had to operate the plane and navigate.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're asking these questions, because I'm continuing to modify things. The Navy crewed their patrol bombers differently than the Air Corps did. We had three commissioned officers, even in the operational aircraft. One was the plane captain, who was by far the most experienced. Then there were two other officers, and they traded assignments as navigators and co-pilots, and you just switch. And so the training and navigation was, of course, the first pilot had already been through that somewhere down the line. It weren't about him, but you were trying to get some exposure for these two cadets that they know a little bit about navigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were more cross-country advanced training at Corpus. There were many more cross-country trips where you would fly to this place and fly to that place and back here and try to find Corpus.
Good luck.
Yeah, back home. Texas was one of my favorite places, though. This was in 1944, you know. And Texas sky, once in a while in Kentucky, you'll get what I call a Texas sky, where it's just blue as you can imagine, with perfectly white clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And to fly among those clouds solo in the Vulti, for instance, open cockpit, was an experience that I've never forgotten. So when I see, we had one the other day here, and we have them down in that place down in Tennessee occasionally, Texas sky.
Brings back good memories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you, do you remember any of your free time in Corpus Christi?
Yes. Spent a fair amount of time. We had a fair amount of time off, a couple of days a week usually. And Corpus was a big enough town that there was a variety of things to do, some of which attracted young men. Some may not have, I don't know. Texas was a dry state, or at least the county with Corpus is in. I think the whole state was dry. And so the bus stations had racks and racks of lockers. So if you didn't finish the bottle, you stored it in the locker and came back to it the next week or whatever. But usually you weren't sure you'd be back next week, so you didn't leave much. Corpus was very busy because Corpus Christi Air Base was a big operation. Mm. And then there were all kinds of other ones in Texas, of course, all over the state of Texas had beaucoup air bases because of the weather primarily, I think, and flat areas, easy to build airports, and could build them where it didn't impinge on other people.
Mm-hmm.
People were very great about it. The King Ranch, you've probably heard of the King Ranch in Texas, is, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of acres, I guess. I don't know, it's a huge place. Anyway, they made part of their holdings came fairly close to Corpus, and they made available, they had outlying shacks, cabins, maybe where the cowboys slept at night, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And we loved those places. They'd send us out there maybe for a couple of days for an R&R sort of a situation where you were just out isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And never forgotten the King Ranch either, some of those things that kind of stick with you a little bit. And no facilities, just a roof over your head. But,
like camping.
But cowboys.
Then did you get assigned to, I don't know, your crew or your co-pilot at Corpus Christi? Or?
No, we finished. No, we had no assigned crews at that. This is still, we're still cadets.
Okay.
And if you successfully finished your training at Corpus, that's when you got your wings and were commissioned.
Okay, and these are your wings.
And so we were, when those of us that finished, by that time most people finished. The washouts came up much earlier in the program. Mm. And November 1st of 44, finished the training, and we were commissioned and got our wings at that point. And they sewed fabric type things on jackets of our uniforms, you know. And these you could wear under your shirts or whatever you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And they had smaller ones that you could send to your girlfriend or your mother or whatever, and they could wear it as a kind of a pin, you know.
Did you send one to your mom?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to it.
Did
they came both. They came both in this double studded style and a safety pin, kind of a.
Uh-huh. Did you send one to your girlfriend, your now wife?
I must have.
Does she still wear hers?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, I think at that point, the Navy had for decades, maybe centuries, had a tradition that when a seaman first crossed the equator, they devised what they called a short snorter bill. Now, there were so many people doing it, and some of those rules kind of were eased to a great extent. And this is my short snorter bill, but I did not ever cross the equator, so it couldn't have been for that. My guess is that we did this when we finished at Corpus Christi. I don't know. All your friends and signed the thing.
It's kind of like a yearbook or something. Everybody signs it.
Some of the signatures I can read in there, but not too many of them. There were a couple of close friends in there. One of us who turned out to be our best man at our wedding, and the other one was a groomsman. Names are on there.
Wow.
They finished about the same time I did. Valuable souvenirs. I don't know how that'll do in the auction after we're gone.
I'm sure your family will hold on to that.
Yeah, I don't know if I've talked to him about that. I just happened to burn into that yesterday.
Did in the course of this training, this is over a year you've been.
Yeah,
training
it was
so far.
Finally, it was 18 months from the time we were called up in May of 43 and. Finished in November of 44.
And you're part of the Navy. At this point, had you done any time on the water?
Mm-mm. Swam in the swimming pool.
They didn't put you in a little canoe?
A little aside on that one. At Monmouth, one of our instructors, physical education instructor, was an officer, and his name was Art Paskvin. He was a running back or a fullback at the University of Wisconsin. And one of the things we had swimming exercises, and one of his favorites was when you get too tired to swim anymore, do push-ups on the bottom. Art Paskvin, he was a great football player.
So you hadn't.
And I ended up graduating from the University of Wisconsin after the war. We haven't come to that yet.
Yeah. So you just, other than the swimming courses at Monmouth and stuff, you hadn't had any. Like water training or?
Oh, yeah, a lot of swimming and treading water. And a lot of the guys didn't know how to swim when they enlisted in the Navy. I was fortunate enough, the schools we had in Rockford, even at junior high school level, had swimming pools. So, and again, we're fortunate enough, our parents were able occasionally to go to a lake up in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so I knew how to swim pretty well to start with, but some of them just didn't know how to keep above their head above water. And they had grading, had levels of accomplishment that you had to meet as you went along.
Mm-hmm. And did they teach you anything about emergency landings over water, or what if your plane went over water?
Well, mainly how to use your clothing, for instance, as floats. Your shirt, you could tie it in certain ways and inflate it, and it would keep you. It helped keep you afloat for all your pants, your trousers. Other things like that. Treading water, of course, wasn't how to act if there's another person in the water with you, mm-hmm. who might be desperate, how to make sure you don't go down with them, and that, all that, that sort of emergency, yeah. sort of water training. As far as emergency landings of airplanes in the water, there wasn't much need, because they were going to be land-based bombers that we flew anyway. They were not going to be seaplanes.
So after Corpus Christi, and you've got your wings, and I guess now you're commissioned.
Right? An ensign. Mm-hmm.
And where did you go?
Then we went to Jacksonville, Florida. But before, well, okay, went to Jacksonville, Florida. That was for, they call that, Corpus was called advanced training. Jacksonville was operational training. And there we flew those PBYs, mm-hmm. The kind that my uncle flew in the Black Hat Squadron. Pardon me, is another transition to larger and larger airplanes. Mm-hmm. But we did, all the ones that we flew there were seaplanes. We landed and took off from the St. John's River in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever made an open ocean landing in them. I think they felt that it, one of those situations where the first time you do it,
to make it as easy on you as they can.
Well, yeah, and it was risky enough that they didn't think it was, that your first time you do it might as well be the emergency, mm-hmm. when you had to do it. Mm-hmm. Taught you techniques and, you know, how to land relative to the waves and how high they were and wind velocities and that sort of thing, to make it as easy a emergency landing as you could. And in the airplanes we ended up in were land-based bombers, so that was just a matter of hoping that you landed softly enough that you could get out of the airplane some way.
Yeah.
Not the idea that the airplane would float, because it wouldn't float.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in Jacksonville?
Well, up to and beyond when we got married.
How did that happen?
Well, finished the training down to Corpus, and we had a little leave then at that, and went back to Rockford, and Joyce did some hard negotiating and convinced me we ought to get married.
She had to convince you.
This, she won't hear this, will she?
Yes. Joyce, I'm giving you a copy of this.
Well, I think we were both ready at that time. In the matter of setting a date, Joyce was at Rockford College in her senior year, and she had a break in their Christmas break in school, so we planned the wedding around that, which turned out to be the 23rd of December, and we're together until she had to go back to school. She went back to Rockford after our honeymoon and finished that semester, and then came back down to Jacksonville, mm-hmm. with me, and she dropped out that final semester and finished that later. Then after Jacksonville, we went to another great seaport, Hutchinson, Kansas.
And was she able to go with you?
Yes, for the rest of the way. Yes,
that's great.
The rest of the way. And there we the next transition was to a B-24 four-engine heavy bomber. Mm-hmm. And the missions were still going to be low-level, not strategic bombing, but what's the other word? Tactical. Mm-hmm. Anti-shipping, anti-submarine support for landing forces. Probably, if the war had gone on, probably we would have been in a support situation with the troops landing in Japan. That'd be my guess, because we never were trained with a Norden bomb sight for high-level strategic bombings. Unless they did that after the war some way, but it was not ever a part of our training. Mm-hmm. It was all going to be low-level training. So Hutchinson, Kansas was, again, just more advanced work, more ground, more learning about that airplane, which at the time was a B-24. Liberator, it was called. The Air Corps called it a Liberator, and the Navy did too at that point. Mm-hmm. They designate that the P, let's see, PB4Y1 was a Liberator, the Navy's designation for the B-24. Mm-hmm. And then late in the war, the Navy had that airplane modified. The B-24 had a little background, had twin tails on it. And it was a very difficult airplane to fly if you lost an engine. I weighed about 135 pounds then, which is not far from what I weigh now. And one of the exercises was cutting two engines on one side of the airplane and trying to figure out how to get it down safely with two engines. And even with the both feet on the pedal, I could not hold the airplane flying straight with all the strength I could. When the Navy modified that, they went to a single fin and rudder, which in square feet was much larger than the combined area of the two twin tails on the B-24. So it was much easier to handle in an emergency situation where you lost one or two engines on one side. Mm-hmm. And then they added more armor to it. They added more armament to it. They put bigger engines on it, and that was going to be the airplane that we eventually would go overseas with into combat. Mm-hmm. And so the B-24 at Hutchinson, Kansas was a transition into that, where we were flying really heavy airplanes and a lot of night flying and cross-country flights. They went from Hutchinson, Kansas, which was in a dry area. They flew to Minneapolis and loaded up on booze at the Naval Air Station in Minneapolis and flew it back to Hutchinson, Kansas.
Well, if these were bombers, did you practice any bombing in Kansas?
No, not that I recall. We did in Jacksonville. Bombs. They simulated at targets, and they would send you out. They said the target's here, but they sent you this. You had to get there on a multi-stop sort of a situation, and conduct a search. It was like a raft they would put out in the ocean somewhere there, and you were to find it and drop these simulated bombs on it.
Yeah.
And a lot of crews never did find that darn thing. They had methods of doing dead reckoning, it was called, and that was flying by the seat of your pants, really.
Yeah.
And you knew it was in this general area, but you didn't know where it was. And it was an exercise called a square search. And you would fly in one direction for a number of minutes, and then you'd turn 90 degrees and fly this way for a number of minutes, and that way, and you'd keep decreasing the size of that square.
Mm-hmm.
This assumption being that somewhere in that biggest square is that you'd find it, you'd eventually find it on a search like that. And our crew happened to find that. So the enlisted men on the crew, they thought they were the greatest things that ever walked the earth. I think it was mostly luck.
They had lined up their bigger square just right.
Yeah. But we didn't, we never dropped in live bombs in practice. Now, maybe they did when I got out and the rest of the crew went on overseas,
mm-hmm.
after the war. Maybe they did practice those. I would think they would have to, but I don't know that.
It just seems that there would need to be some kind of practice about how the plane reacts.
Yeah.
When you take off with 4,000 or 5,000 pounds,
yeah.
and then you let it go.
Yeah. I think most of these airplanes, they didn't drop... what did they call them when they dropped a whole string of bombs at one?
We saw lots of
pictures of that in World War II from high-level
mm-hmm.
strategic bombing. The Navy's, I think, they released one at a time because
mm-hmm.
they were after a merchant ship or they were after a submarine or something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they dropped two or three in a bracket situation. But we never did it in a live situation where we actually dropped something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe that was scheduled when the war was over, because the war was over very suddenly. And when we finished at San Diego, we were going to Kaneohe Bay in Honolulu,
mm-hmm.
Oahu.
Now, San Diego, where you went after Kansas?
Yes.
Okay.
After Kansas, no, went to Miami.
Oh.
Back to Florida, to Miami. Yeah.
Well, let's back up to there. What's going on in Miami?
Just more training. That's where in later years I got to thinking that maybe they created that thing to accommodate a bunch of officers that they weren't ready really to deploy out somewhere in the Pacific. I'm not sure about that. But it didn't seem to me that it was absolutely necessary to have both Jacksonville and in Miami. Because it just seemed kind of like duplicative to me a little bit, yeah. But we had a good time there.
What was your training like in Miami?
Pretty much 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. We lived on, found an apartment on Miami Beach. Lived about 200 yards from the ocean, I guess. Mm-hmm. Joyce was there, of course, and had gotten to know some people pretty well. Social life was good. Didn't feel threatened. So it was, in fact, I called the whole time that Joyce and I were married in this thing a year's honeymoon at Uncle Sam's expense. That was closer to the truth than it was a war experience.
Yeah.
That's why I hesitated about this thing, because I just, as far as my service is concerned, it was,
but it's important too. I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You saw a lot of how the country was.
Yeah, I wasn't the only one in that situation, of course. Lots of other people were too. But even the people who really were in the war, like Bob Sleemaker, for instance. You know about Bob?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is he? Have you talked to him?
No, he's hesitant to talk about his war experience.
He's doing something on his own.
And I think that's understandable. I mean, I think.
Because he was really, I think, Battle of the Bulge, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I think, San Maria Iglesias?
Yeah.
The little town where the guys got caught in the...
In the church town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he was there, too. He told me that, as I've been urging him I said, have your kids seen your citation? You know, he got the Silver Star, which is right next to the Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And not many people get that. I want to try to be sure that his children knew about some of these things, because he's so hesitant to talk about it. He wears the ribbon
mm-hmm.
often.
Mm-hmm.
And I once asked him what it was, and that's when he told me it was a Silver Star. You know, I didn't know. Bob and I have diametrically opposing viewpoints on lots of things, politics, for instance, but can't help but
admire that.
And he told me not too long ago that he was working on some information for his kids, I guess,
good.
And grandchildren, so I hope he does that.
Good.
Keep after him, will you? Do you intend to? Did he shut you off?
I think Jim has opened the door for him, but I'm, you know, I can understand and, you know, respect his decision that, and I'll pause this for just a second here. You're long. Let's see. Okay, we're picking this back up here. We've taken a moment to talk about with some other friends of ours who are veterans and hope to encourage them to share their stories. But picking up your story again, you and Joyce were in Miami. On your honeymoon, and
well, Jacksonville was really the honeymoon. Yeah, the earlier one, Miami. Well, yeah, part of the year's honeymoon. Yes.
Yeah.
yeah. You're too quick for me, Leah.
And so, did you fly in Miami?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just more advanced stuff, and but really kind of a 9 to 5 sort of a schedule on it. Night flying, some of course, and. Navigation was getting a little more advanced,
mm-hmm.
learning more about celestial navigation. And I think we were only there 3 months, I guess, but it was a pretty easy 3 months, really.
Yeah. And what were you hearing about the war during this time?
Well, by that time, the tide was turning to some extent, mm-hmm. as there had never been any doubt to start with that we'd end up winning this thing, but it was a matter of how quickly we could do it, how strong the Japanese were, and all kinds of other things, what the British were doing and what. But we were always aware that of progress, and most of the news by that time was starting to be progress. There weren't too many serious. We took losses, but not defeats.
Mm-hmm. And from Miami, where did they send you from Miami?
San Diego. We had a little leave after that and went back to Rockford for a few days and then took a train from Rockford to San Diego. Mm-hmm. Kind of a cattle car sort of a thing. But
you put
still,
Joyce on a cattle car?
At that age, you don't worry too much about that kind of stuff. So it was about a five-day trip, I think, from Rockford to San Diego. And the uncle I referred to you earlier, called you Uncle Bob, he was stationed in San Diego. He was the executive officer at a naval station there in San Diego area. It was, I'll think of it, I guess. Anyway, he was executive officer there, having come back from extensive tours in the South Pacific. And they had bought a house in San Diego, and the house next door was occupied by a woman whose husband was overseas somewhere and had an extra bedroom. Mm-hmm. And so they arranged with that lady for us to rent that room from that woman who lived right next door. Camp Kearney was the name of the station. And San Diego was, and of course the war was getting pretty close to the end at that time. We didn't know about the bombs. I was still convinced that we were going to be over there where there was action, but things were moving pretty rapidly in our direction, mm-hmm. even at the cost of, you know, very severe losses along the way in that island hopping campaign. But San Diego is a great city. Even then it was. Lots of things to do. It was a great, had been a naval station for many, many years, was and maybe still is a favorite place for Navy officers to retire. Mm-hmm. And the San Diego Zoo is outstanding. There's just lots of things to see and do in San Diego. And by that time, we had transitioned to this PB4Y2, which was the Navy called a privateer. It was a modified B-24 Liberator. Mm-hmm. So this was the airplane we were going to fly in combat. And so it was a topping off of the computer, of the training, getting used to that particular airplane, its characteristics, its flying characteristics, the equipment that we hadn't seen before, mm-hmm. The different flying characteristics also, its additional power. It had more guns and had more armor, more protection around the pilot's cockpit. And it was just a far superior airplane. I don't think that the Air Corps ever used that model. I don't think they did. There have always been service rivalries, even in war, for heaven's sakes. There's rivalries, you know. And there were a lot of fist fights, for heaven's sakes, between Marines and Navy guys. I shouldn't say a lot of them, but it wasn't unknown, particularly if the bistro was late, you were there late at night. So again, San Diego was a good time for Joyce and I with our relatives next door and my favorite relative, I guess, my Uncle Bob, the aviator, was there. And there our crews were assembled then. We were organized as a crew that would stay together. Mm-hmm. And our plane captain, his name was John Straker, was an Annapolis graduate and had extensive tours of duty in the South Pacific in other airplanes, and came back and he was getting updated in this privateer. And two of us who alternated as co-pilots and navigators, the other fellow was Bill Haney, and he was married and about my age. John Straker was older by maybe 8 or 9 years, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And our enlisted men crew, which there were enlisted people who knew more about the radios, mm-hmm. they knew more about the mechanics of the airplane, they would man the guns, they would probably man the the armament, the bomb dropping duties, and generally had housekeeping kind of things to do with the airplane itself, making sure it was ready for flight, the plane commander, of course, the plane commander was ultimately responsible for deciding if the airplane was airworthy for a particular flight. But he had to depend on, I think we had about 7 or 8 enlisted men plus the 3 commissioned officers on these airplanes.
And were those enlisted men, were they?
Yes.
They were assigned to your
plane? Yes,
your
it was
so
a crew.
It was always the same, okay.
And the intention, of course, when this was done, the bombs had not yet been dropped. So the assumption was that this was going to be a crew that would stay together for some time and through whatever action in which you might become involved. Mm-hmm. So the bonding, is the word used now, was very important. And there had to be a confidence among the crew that that your buddy next door knew what the heck he was doing, you know. And you could depend on them. And that, of course, pyramided up to the plane captain, who carried a heavy load of responsibility in that respect, that he had to be, there had to be confidence in him, in his ability and capability and character.
Did you have a good captain?
Very good. As you would expect out of the Naval Academy.
Annapolis will be glad to hear. So how long were you in San Diego? You had mentioned that you were going to
I think we got there in June, I think. I think we got there in June of 45, and the bombs were dropped in August. We had just finished our training. And
so you were
one was
San
the first
Diego.
One was dropped on about the 11th of August, maybe the other one a few days later, Nagasaki.
And you were still at San Diego when that happened?
Yeah.
Do you remember where you were when you heard about
Yeah, I think we were next door with my uncle's wife. And the news came on the radio, and I remember saying to her, my God, this, and this is only the first one. This is the smallest one, you know. What comes next? And very sobering, even as young as we were and inexperienced and immature, and it was a life-changing kind of a, things are different.
So you immediately knew the implications of this type of bomb on
that could do such tremendous damage.
Do you, the next day when you
there was no regret that it was done, don't misunderstand me, and there still isn't
but
on my part,
but there was just an understanding of the implications. And the next day when you went to onto base or met with your crew, was there any talk about whether this was going to be it?
I think actually by that time they we had stopped our formal training. We had finished it. And we're waiting for orders to go to Honolulu, so the next stage, you know. And I think we were through with our formal training. In fact, I know we were because I prevailed on my uncle Bob to let me and a friend of mine use one of the small two-place airplanes to have some fun with it. And he arranged that for me, and when I came back in, I dropped the thing from about 15 feet, I guess, and blew out a tire. So I don't know how he explained that to his superiors. And his hot pilot nephew blew a tire in his landing. So that, yes, we were through with the deferral training, and we had been, we were going to get some liberty or some leave at that point. And which we got and went back to Rockford. And things happened very rapidly. When the war was over, it just wasn't many days when they set, they had assigned point levels to how much, how long you'd been in the, and what kind of service you had, and they assigned point levels for that. And the point level assigned to folks who like ensigns like I was had first been set at some higher level, and when I run this final leave there, expecting to go overseas, but by the time we got back to San Diego a couple weeks later, they had lowered those points to a to a level where I qualified to get out, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And even though I had signed the papers to sign over to the regular Navy, I withdrew those things amid some less than friendly remarks from the officers who probably were getting credit for keeping guys in.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
And so we elected to get out then with a chance to go back to school in January, the following January. And
so you never hooked back up with your crew? And
no, not in any formal way. I did go back for a year later, I guess it was, for some reserve training at Glendale Naval Air Station near Chicago. That's an additional story, I guess. But they stayed in, and I really lost track of them there for a while. And I'm really not sure where they ended. I know they went to Kaneohe Bay in Honolulu. How they replaced me or with who, or I don't know. But the crew was intact at that point, and I was part of that crew. So when I withdrew, it, you know, left a donut hole there.
Yeah, and they had to find
had to do something. And then what they did in Kaneohe or beyond, I don't know. They probably went further. Maybe went to Okinawa. I don't know where they went. Replaced other crews probably, because we were still hadn't signed the peace treaty thing, and there's still lots to do in those areas. Some of those Jap forces, they stayed in the Philippines, I think, for years in the hills up there. Some of them did.
Yeah.
And just didn't believe that that Japan surrendered. They just wouldn't believe it. They were taught to fight to the death, you know, and they assumed the country would. Anyway, strange things happened.
So you and Joyce went back to San Diego, and you not quit the service.
No,
but you took the
Joyce
option.
Stayed in Rockford at that point.
Oh, she stayed in Rockford.
Yeah, because she went back to went back to school to finish that last semester.
And then you came home from San Diego and started school
in January of 1946. That would be discharged on the 1st of November, I think. Commissioned on the 1st of November and discharged on the 1st of November.
An even year. Did you where did you go to school when you came back?
Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, Madison, which was a bigger campus, better chance for Joyce to get employment, and fairly close to Rockford. Pardon me. I think it was the proximity of Wisconsin. It's larger chance for Joyce to get something to do. Oxford, Ohio, wouldn't have been many opportunities for her to get work. In those days, the town wasn't, 5,000 people maybe? I don't know. Beautiful campus, loved it. But my sister graduated from there. But so there was no thought of returning to Oxford, Ohio.
And when you went to...
Didn't like Illinois. So
when you went to Wisconsin, did you have a GI Bill?
Yes.
That would help get you through college?
Yes, they were rapid. The enlistments were exploding at that time with guys coming back from the service and wanting to go back to school under the GI Bill, which enabled hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them to go to college who never would have without that chance. So that was another benefit of the war that sometimes is overlooked, but it was a tremendous benefit. I think I would have gotten there anyway, some way or another, because I had a taste of it before the war. What was your question?
Well, yeah, you used the GI Bill, and
we had, pardon me, one of the fellows in our wedding, name is Blaine Hendrickson. He and his wife, he was from Madison, and he went back to school there, and they helped us. Well, first of all, the accommodations available at that time for out-of-state people just find a place to live, it was difficult because they were filling up rapidly. And we first stayed in barracks used by nurses during the war. Since there was I think the Army Air Corps had some kind of facility in Madison. And they had barracks for the nurses, and when they were disbanded, those spaces were available. So we had 10 by 10 room, I guess, with a double deck iron bedstead, and two little rooms with a bathroom in between them, I guess. But our friends that lived in Madison found us a one room bedroom in town, where we stayed in a room, one out of 11 rooms in that remodeled old house, with one bedroom, with one bathroom.
Oh, my.
In an ice box. In an ice box. Not a refrigerator, an ice box. The ice was delivered on Saturdays, I guess, and on Saturdays we slept in, so we just left the door open. The guy would come in with a 50-pound chunk of ice and put it in the, in the ice box and on his way. Anyway, great days. I got credit for, I got credit for two semesters. I got the credits I had from Illinois, and I think we're equal to two. To a full year, because I went, started in January, went straight through three semesters a year for 2 years. That's six, right? It takes, so it must have been two that I got credit for. Majored in accounting, primarily, I guess, because my dad wasn't a certified accountant, but he was an accountant. That was part of his responsibilities as office manager and his job in Rockford. That was the attraction, I guess. And I don't regret majoring in it, because it's a it's a good major for anybody, including liberal arts peoples, I think. And went straight through, had a great time there. Bought our first automobile up there, and the only convertible we ever owned. 39 Plymouth convertible with a rumble seat. You don't even know what a rumble seat is, do you?
I believe I do.
Do you?
It pops up, doesn't it?
Yeah. And this one, probably one of the first ones that had a power-operated rooftop on it.
Oh, my.
Most of them, up until that point, you had, were manual. You had to,
yeah, you had to get out, yeah, the latch.
So you popped a button. And so that was great to go to football games with somebody in the rumble seat. So that just took 2 years. I'm jumping over something, probably.
Well, you know, I think you've covered your war and your service, and afterwards, I always like to ask at the end, just kind of a
aware?
I'm aware of the time.
Okay.
But I do want you to tell me, when you reflect back on your service and in that time during World War II, you know, how did that impact, what did that mean for the rest of your life? How did that change you or direct you?
If I had to, if somebody said, what were the 30 best months of your life? It'd be those 30 months.
Was that the friendships, the adventure?
Hard to put into words.
Yeah. Did you ever fly?
Because I've had lots of, been very fortunate, had lots of great 30 months, but significant 30 months, feeling that you were doing, headed for doing something worthwhile. Meeting and marrying Joyce.
Did you ever fly again? To pilot a plane? Or?
Yeah, a couple years later, in 1948, I think it was, because I stayed in the reserves. And you had to, so often you didn't have to, I guess, but you had an opportunity to go back to Glenview Naval Air Station from where I lived in Rockford. For flight some more flight training, back to the Beechcraft, twin-engine Beechcraft we flew, and went back there, and it was ground school, and jets were just coming in, and then there was some ground school information about that sort of thing. Nothing very intensive, but they did, you did fly, and they assigned you a crew, two of us, and this particular assignment was a cross-country flight, and I thought, well, we'll fly down across Joyce's farmstead, where she grew up on a farm in central Illinois. And I don't think the only training that updating training that they gave us were, I don't know, three or four landings. And okay, go. And it had been 2 years since I'd flown, and we got down over that farm, and both engines quit.
Oh, my word.
And neither one of us had flown since, or we were uncertain about what. And we were down to 500 feet, I guess, when we finally, both of us, and my God, we forgot to switch the gas tanks. And everything, that all the controls were at full.
Yeah.
There was a word for that, when the pitch and the power were full on. When the engines came on, they just thought they were going to tear themselves out of the airplane. So anyway, we both reached for the levers that switched the gas tanks. Mm-hmm. There's a procedure that you do. You take off on certain tanks, and when you're up and flying, then you switch to other tanks, mm-hmm. and then you switch back to those other tanks. It's things that you do automatically if you fly enough.
Yeah.
And if you don't fly enough, you're not a safe air. You're not a safe aviator, and you should pilot, and you shouldn't do it. And after that experience, I decided if I couldn't fly regularly, I better not fly at all.
Yeah.
So that was the last of it.
Unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you had a good experience, and I'm glad you shared it with me and with the Library of Congress and the Kentucky Historical Society and with your family, who will be glad to get a copy.
Okay, well, bless your heart for volunteering to do this sort of thing.
Well, thank you for volunteering to serve in the service.
You're late now.